And we were discussing Arjuna's fourth reason for not wishing to fight. To recapitulate briefly, Arjuna's logic, which was impeccable, was that when the elders in the family perish in the battle, as would inevitably happen, then the elders would no longer be around to protect the family traditions in respect of dharma, and therefore, because the family traditions would no longer exist, the family would become irreligious. When the family became involved in irreligious activities, then the women, being unprotected and seeing the bad example of the menfolk engaging in adharmic activities, would also themselves begin to engage in adharma or irreligion. And when the women fall into irreligion because of the menfolk also doing so and the lack of spiritual guidance, then the women will become polluted. Strishu dushta suvarshneya jayate varna sankaraha. And then unwanted children will be born. And this unwanted children, as Arjuna has stated in the shloka that we discussed last time, sankaro narakayeva kulajnanam kulasyacha. So when these unwanted children populate the whole world, it creates a hellish situation. Because these children are born either out of wedlock, or even if it is within the bounds of marriage, such children have never been procreated in a spiritual consciousness. No samskaras have been performed, which are ritualistic purificatory ceremonies that are considered mandatory according to Vedic culture for begetting pure-hearted offspring. So the children who are born are demoniac in nature. And we discussed last time that every day millions and millions of little rakshasas are being born every day in our world in the present time because of lack of purification, because no samskars are performed right from the garbhadhana samskar, which is supposed to be performed even when the couple is about to conceive. That is the time from which the samskars begin. So therefore, these children who are born, when they grow up, they create a hellish situation in the world for their elders, when the elders are living. And when the elders are dead, they create a further hellish situation. Why is that? As he explains here, patanti pitaro hyesham lupta pindodaka kriyah. Patanti pitaro. Pitris means the forefathers. They may have died. And they are all according to the karma in different destinations. Patanti, they fall down in these conditions of life. Maybe some of them, because of their sinful activities in the past, have assumed the bodies of ghosts, which is a body that is extremely prone to suffering, a miserable condition of life to be in. We think that to be troubled by a ghost is troublesome, but to be a ghost is even more troublesome. It's even greater misery to be a ghost. Because you have all your desires, but you're not able to fulfill it for want of a physical body. So therefore, all the ancestors who may, because of their sins, be languishing either in hell or in a ghostly body or in some other abominable position, are meant to be delivered by the descendants by performance of Pinda and Udaka Kriya. This is basically the Shraddha ceremony. We discussed the details of the Shraddha ceremony to some extent last Saturday. So it is mandatory for descendants, especially for the son, to perform this ritual for the deliverance of the forefathers. And the purpose of begetting a son is so that he can perform this ceremony. And that's why he is called Putra. Putra. Pum nama narakat trayate iti putraha. Putra is one who delivers the forefathers from the hell called Pum. And the word tra comes from trayate, which means to deliver. Just like kshatriya. Kshat trayate. One who delivers the praja from suffering or who protects them is called kshatriya. So similarly, the word tra in putra also is from trayate. Son is one who delivers the forefathers from any hellish conditions that they may have fallen into because of past sinful activity. So Arjuna is saying that when the woman folk become polluted, then there are unwanted children. Because of unwanted children, a hellish situation is created all over the society. And all these activities like Shraddha, etc. are stopped. The forefathers fall down into their hellish conditions of life. And then what is going to happen after, Arjun will continue. But just a small point to note as a reminder before we go ahead. We discussed also that for a devotee of Lord Krishna, he is not obliged to perform these Shraddha ceremonies because he has surrendered to Lord Krishna. As Narad Muni has advised in the Srimad Bhagavatam, when someone surrenders to Lord Krishna utterly, he or she becomes completely relieved of all other obligations in life. Otherwise, as we saw, we have six kinds of debts that we are born with from the moment of our birth till we die. And these debts have to be discharged towards the demigods, towards the sages, towards the human society in general, towards living beings in general, towards our forefathers, and even towards our relatives. These six kinds of debts have to be discharged because we owe these six categories something. We are obtaining some benefit from them. So unless we discharge our debts to these six categories of living beings according to specified ways, we will have to suffer for that karma in the future life. But one who surrenders to Krishna is at one stroke relieved from the obligation to discharge the debts to all these six kinds of people or living entities. This is the shortcut if you want to be free from all kinds of debt. Simply surrender. Sarvatmanaya sharanam sharanyam gato mukundam parihrityakartam. If you go to Mukunda, Lord Krishna, gato mukundam parihrityakartam, even if you have given up some of your worldly duties, but you have taken shelter having gone to Mukunda, sarvatmanah sharanyam, you have taken shelter with your heart and soul, then you become freed from all these other obligations. So what happens after such a hellish situation is created? Arjuna will continue now in text 42. So kindly open your books to text number 42 and chant after me.
Doshairetai kulagnanam varnasankarakarakaihi utsadyante jati dharmah kuladharmascha shashvatah.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. By the evil deeds of those who destroy the family tradition and thus give rise to unwanted children, all kinds of community projects and family welfare activities are devastated. So Arjuna is saying that because of all these events that are likely to take, the end result is going to be complete devastation of all welfare activities in the society, destruction of all the jati dharma, kula dharma. In other words, total chaos, which is what we see nowadays. Arjuna's description is very apt for today's times. Now, what is the meaning of this kula dharma or jati dharma that he's talking about? We made a brief reference to this some weeks ago. This jati dharma is not simply some family tradition of dubious origin that somebody concocted some generations ago. Grandfather, great-grandfather, or somebody, some ancestor decided that some tradition should be started, and then everybody goes ahead and does it generation after generation. No. This kula dharma or jati dharma is dharma according to the varnashrama system. There are four varnas and four ashrams. The four varnas are Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, are Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas. And they all have certain specific responsibilities and duties to perform in life. And when people do not perform activities according to their varna and their ashram, then there is chaos. So jati dharma or kula dharma that is referred to here is the varnashram dharma that is meant to be performed by human beings. So these are certain kinds of duties. They are on the material platform, but nevertheless they help us to move on the towards the spiritual platform. For one who is totally spiritually situated in a mode of bhakti to the Lord is not obliged to follow all these regulations, because he has already attained the very objective of following these rules. But nevertheless, people in general must not have a whimsical attitude that yes, I have taken to the path of bhakti, therefore I need not worry. There are certain activities that should not be given up even when we come to bhakti. We will see more about this in the 18th chapter. Yajna, Dan and Tapa. These three activities of sacrifice, charity and penance should never be given up, even by a self-realized person. So Arjuna is bemoaning the fact that this eternal family tradition of varnashram dharma will be completely destroyed, which is the basis of society. And therefore the path for progressive spiritual evolution of the society will be lost, and humankind will become degraded to the animal level. So Arjuna's chain of logic cannot be refuted. So Arjuna goes on further. Let us see what is Arjuna's fear as he goes ahead. Text number 43.
Utsanna kula dharmanam manushyanam janardana narake niyatam vaso bhavati tyanushushruma.
O Krishna, O maintainer of the people, I have heard by disciplic succession that those who destroy family traditions dwell always in hell. So Arjun begins by saying, Utsanna kula dharmanam. All this entire varnashram dharma, kula dharma will be utsanna, it will be destroyed. Manushyanam janardana. The use of the word manushyanam is significant because it means that unless human society follows this varnashram dharma, it is not really a human society. It is simply an animal society. An animal society has no rules and regulations. There is no dharma for the animals. But human beings have dharma. We have to live our life according to certain rules and regulations as laid down in the scripture. And this is varnashram dharma. So if varnashram dharma disappears, then humanity ceases to be human. Isn't that the condition today in our world, in the modern society? A man has become like an animal. ruthless, devoid of all human qualities like love, compassion, forgiveness, brotherhood, and so on. And furthermore, Arjuna uses the word Anushushruma. Narake niyate vaso, that all these people will dwell in hell, so I have heard. Anushushruma. From whom? I have heard in parampara. So Arjuna is basing his entire logic not upon his whims and fancies, but he is basing his logic or his knowledge upon what he has heard in the parampara, the disciplic succession. This is the proper way to attain knowledge. True knowledge is never attained by our own concoctions or speculations. It is very common these days to find people who will say, especially they come to us in the temple or when we go out for programs, then they will counter by saying, you see, in my opinion, Lord Krishna did like this, or in my opinion, it is like this. So Srila Prabhupada used to get very annoyed when people used to speak like this. And at one time he said, what is the value of your opinion? Your opinion has no value. And just to make the point clearer, he said, even my opinion has no value. He said, the Lord's opinion is the only opinion that has value. And when we repeat the Lord's opinion, then our opinion becomes meaningful. Because it is the Lord's opinion, not because it's my opinion. All of us in this world are subjected to four defects. We have imperfect senses. We have a tendency to make mistakes. We have a tendency to be illusioned, and we have a propensity to cheat. With these four defects, it is not possible for us to acquire perfect knowledge. Therefore, that perfect knowledge has to be acquired from a higher authority. Even in ordinary matters of in everyday life, we accept this principle, so why not in the realm of spiritual knowledge? Therefore, in the Ishopanishad, it is said, Anyad eva ahur vidyaya, anyad ahur avidyaya, iti shushrumadhiranam yenastat vichachakshire. The saint is praying that by cultivating vidya, that is real knowledge, one gets one result. By cultivating avidya, anyad ahur avidyaya, one gets another result. By studying spiritual subjects, you get one result. By studying material subjects, you get another result. Iti shushruma dhirana. Thus we have heard. Shushruma means to hear. Thus we have heard. From whom? Dhirana. From those who are dhir. Dhir means those who are sober. Those whose senses are controlled. Those who have understood the higher spiritual subject by realization. Yenastat vichachakshire. Vichachakshire means to explain. So real knowledge about what is spiritual life and what is not, what is ignorance and what is knowledge, has to be understood in parampara of dhiras. Not necessarily in a parampara of father, grandfather, great-grandfather. No. If they happen to be dhiras, that is fine. Or if they happen to be repeating the words of dhiras, that is fine. So Arjuna is saying here, bhavatiti anushushruma, that I have heard whatever I have said in parampara of great saints. My dear Krishna, it is not that I am concocting whatever I am saying now. I have actually heard. This means that even the kings would regularly attend spiritual discourses. The king, according to Chanakya, is expected to spend several hours every day studying the Shastras and having discourses and discussions on spiritual subjects with the sages. Have you seen any of our political leaders doing this? No. It is a duty of the king in particular. Because if the king doesn't act according to laws of dharma, how will the praja or the subjects act? Yatha raja, tatha praja. As the king is, so shall the subjects act. So Arjuna is saying here very clearly that because I have heard in tradition like this, therefore I am saying all this, dear Krishna. Don't think that I am just trying to concoct something. So Arjuna is now building up his case very strongly. He would have been an excellent lawyer. He is making his case stronger and stronger with each argument. And then he comes on to text 44. So kindly open to text 44.
Aho batamahat papam kartum vyavasitavayam yadraja sukhalobhena hantum svajanam udyataha.
Translation: alas, how strange it is that we are preparing to commit greatly sinful acts. Driven by the desire to enjoy royal happiness, we are intent on killing our own kinsmen. So Arjuna is extremely aggrieved that in order to obtain the rulership of the kingdom, he is being forced to kill his own relatives. We have already seen in the earlier parts of this chapter how distressed Arjuna has become. So he is saying, Aho bata mahat papam, alas, what kind of great sin are we going to perform? And for what? Yad rajya sukhalobhena, just out of greed for enjoying royal opulence. So Arjuna is a very compassionate person, being a devotee of Lord Krishna. So for his own enjoyment, he doesn't want to cause any distress to others. This is a natural quality of a devotee. And in particular, when it comes to enjoying opulence or a kingdom at the expense of the lives of your loved ones, that is something extremely horrible for a devotee or for anyone who is civilized to contemplate. So Arjuna is thinking that if I have to get rulership of this kingdom, I will have to kill them. This is such a great sin. Hantum svajanam udyataha, I'll have to kill my svajana. Therefore, I don't want to fight. But do you realize the basic mistake Arjuna is making here in this verse? This is a place where you can catch the fallacy. What is the fallacy that Arjuna is making here? Arjuna is thinking that the war is being fought for his satisfaction. That Kurukshetra battle is being performed or is taking place so that he can become king, so that he can enjoy the kingdom. This is the mistake he is making. What is the fact? Krishna did not arrange the battle of Kurukshetra for the pleasure of Arjuna and the Pandavas. Then what did he arrange it for? For his own pleasure, for his own purposes. Lord Krishna had his own purpose to fulfill. What is that purpose? Paritranaya sadhunam, vinashaya cha dushkritam, dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. This is Krishna's purpose. He descends into the world to do these activities. So when the vinashaya cha dushkritam, when the number of dushkritas all over the world became unbearable for Mother Earth, so Lord Krishna had to take recourse to such an event to bring all these people together and finish them all in a short span of 18 days. So Lord Krishna has arranged this whole scenario of this battle just for the sake of fulfilling his mission for which he has descended here. It is not meant simply so that Arjuna can enjoy royal life. So therefore, because Arjuna is acting according to the instructions of Lord Krishna, Therefore, there is no sin involved. Just as when a soldier acts according to the instructions of his commander, then he is not taken to jail and hung. On the contrary, if he acts on his own, of his own accord, without reference to the instructions of superior authority, then he will be jailed. So similarly, if we act according to the instructions of the Lord, then even though that activity may be considered to be sinful or immoral or improper by worldly considerations, because it is being ordered to us by the supreme authority, Lord Krishna, it is not sin. This is a very important point to understand, that the killing that Arjuna is going to be doing is not sin, because he is doing it to fulfill the mission of the Lord. He is doing it expressly on the instructions of the Lord. Krishna wants him specifically to fight. Krishna orders him, you fight. Therefore, there is no blame on Arjuna. But Arjuna at this time has not yet developed this idea. He has not yet understood this point, because this is right in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is still confused about what is sin and what is not sin. Lord Krishna can never be tainted with sin, because whatever the Lord does is all good. This is the meaning of God. There are many people who have not heard Bhagavad Gita in parampara, and they may be very learned scholars of Sanskrit, they may be professors, they may be pandits, but because they have not understood in parampara of dhiras, therefore they are apt to misunderstand Gita and Lord Krishna. So sometimes people criticize that actually Lord Krishna has done a grave mistake by inducing Arjuna to perform acts of violence. Violence is bad. Therefore, what Krishna has done is a grave mistake. But they do not understand that Bhagavad Gita is not a book of non-violence. Neither is it a book of violence. Bhagavad Gita or spiritual life is not necessarily connected with violence or non-violence. Bhagavad Gita is connected with surrendering to Krishna and doing His will. If Krishna wants us to be violent, we should be violent. And then, to be non-violent is a violence. And if Krishna wants you to be non-violent, then you should be non-violent. This is the highest dharma. Just follow what the Lord says. This is the perfection of our life. We have to abandon our independence. We have to use our independence to abandon our independence and follow the instructions of the Lord to the last word. This is real Krishna consciousness. This is real bhakti. So therefore, Arjuna is about to do that, and there is no mistake. In Bhagavad Gita, we are exposed to Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because people don't understand that He is a Supreme Lord, they misunderstand Him to be an ordinary or even an extraordinary person of this world. So they expect Lord Krishna's behavior to conform to the same standards of morality or behavior that we have in this world. So it is not good for us to be violent. So they say, why is Krishna inducing him to be violent? But Krishna is inducing him to be violent for a higher purpose, which he alone understands. So therefore, Arjuna's activity is perfect, because being guided by Lord Krishna. So when Lord Krishna urges for violence, we should not judge him in the same standards that we judge each other. Because Lord Krishna, being the Lord, is perfect in everything he does. Whatever he does is moral. Whatever he does is good. Now this is a very, very important conception we should have if we are to understand Gita. People don't think that God should be allowed to do anything He likes. Because we are not allowed to do anything we like. So it doesn't sound nice to us If we hear that God can do anything he likes, then that's proper. But spiritual life cannot be understood until we understand this very important point, that Lord Krishna is a supreme personality of Godhead. He is a supreme autocrat. He can do anything he likes, anytime he likes, anyhow he likes. There is no one to question him. He sets the laws, he sets the standards, and we have to obey. But he is not doing this out of any ego. It is explained that for very powerful personalities, we should not find flaws or faults in them. For example, sometimes people criticize Lord Shiva because he moves around with ghosts and hobgoblins, and they say that sometimes he takes bhang and such intoxicants. So there are many who try to imitate Lord Shiva doing this, but they can't imitate Lord Shiva drinking the ocean of poison. So therefore one should not find fault with great personalities. Similarly, with Lord Krishna, one should not try to find fault in Lord Krishna's activities because we don't understand really who he is. The sun, for example, is so powerful, it evaporates water from a tiny puddle and even the water of the huge mighty ocean. Millions of tons of water are evaporated daily by the sun in summer. So powerful is the sun. Whenever the sun shines on a filthy place where there is sewage and garbage, it purifies that filthy place. Whatever comes in contact with the sunshine becomes pure, but the sun never becomes polluted. That is the power of something like the sun. So similarly, Lord Krishna, whatever he does, whatever he says, is perfect, is all good. And anyone who comes into contact with the Lord and follows what he says also becomes all pure and all good. So therefore here, Arjuna is being advised by Lord Krishna to fight for Krishna's pleasure. Krishna is telling Arjuna, please fight because I want you to fight. This is the difference between lust and love. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes this difference. Atmendriya priti vancha tare boli kaam, Krishnendriya priti icha dhare premanam. When we work for fulfilling the needs of our own senses, that is called lust. And when we work towards pleasing Lord Krishna, that is called prem or bhakti. So what Arjuna is doing is bhakti. What Duryodhana is doing is kaam or lust. All the two appear to be doing the same thing. Both are shooting arrows, both are fighting on their chariots. But the motivation is different, the authorization is different. This is the important thing to note here. So Arjuna is not being induced to perform sin by Krishna. Krishna is not engaging Arjuna in sin. Rather, Krishna wants to engage Arjuna in seva, in service. So the battle is Arjuna's seva to Lord Krishna. Arjuna is becoming an instrument to fulfill Lord Krishna's mission. So similarly, we all also have to become instruments of Lord Krishna in this world by following the instructions of the Lord and his representatives. So therefore, having declared how devastating the effects of this battle are going to be, now Arjuna is going to announce his intentions. What does Arjuna really want to do now? Now he will make text 45. Kindly repeat after me.
Yadi mam apratikaram ashastram shastrapanayah dhatarashtarane hanyuh tanme kshema taram bhavet.
Translation: better for me if the sons of Dhritarashtra, weapons in hand, were to kill me unarmed and unresisting on the battlefield. So Arjuna is saying, better I just die on the battlefield without fighting. Why is he saying this? First of all, for a Kshatriya, there are certain codes of warfare. If the opposing party doesn't have a weapon, or if the adversary is reluctant to fight, then one should not attack him. This is one of the codes. Now, Arjun says, yadi mam apratikaram, I will not resist. If somebody attacks me, I will not fight. I will not resist him. I will not defend myself. Ashastram, I will also lay down my weapons. Shastrapanayaha, even if they have, if they are holding shastras in their hand. Dhatarashtra, the sons of Dhritarashtra, they may have shastrapanayaha, pani means hand. So they may come towards me with upraised weapons to attack, and I will be without weapons, ashastram, but still apratikaram, I will not counteract that. Pratikar means counteract. Apratikar means I will not counteract. I will just take the weapons and I will die. So why is Arjuna saying this? Because Arjuna is caught between two options. What are the two options? The first option is that he should fight the battle and kill the relatives. And that, as we have already seen, he is loath to do. He says it is greatly sinful and I don't want to do this. So that one option is ruled out. In history, we find so many instances of people who have very readily killed their brothers, fathers, mothers for the sake of a throne. Isn't it? Aurangzeb, he killed his brother Dara Shikoh for the throne, imprisoned his father just for the sake of a throne. So many such instances we find in history. Arjuna doesn't want to be in the category of Aurangzeb. He is a civilized person. So therefore, this option was ruled out for Arjuna. So what was the second option? Second option was for him then to leave the... But if he left the battlefield, then what would he do? Fighting the battle, winning it, and obtaining the kingdom was the only way that he could engage in his occupational duties as a Kshatriya. The only occupational duty for a Kshatriya is to rule. A Kshatriya cannot go and take employment anywhere, and certainly he cannot beg. He cannot do business. So then if he left the battlefield and went away, the only source of his livelihood and employment would have disappeared. So he would have to go and beg. But for a Kshatriya, begging is abominable. It is worse than death. This is the Kshatriya spirit. There is a story that comes to mind in this regard. When Bhima went into the Himalayas to look for a 1,000-petal lotus that Draupadi took a fancy to, he met Hanuman. And after he met Hanuman, he went further ahead into the mountains. And as he went ahead, he came to a very beautiful scenic spot. And this was a lake of Kuver. And as he approached, many yakshas and rakshasas came in his way and threatened him. And they said, you dare not go proceed beyond this point, because no humans can do this. This is a lake of Kuver, and you will be trespassing on his property. So you should go and take his permission, and then you may take the flower if you like. And if you do not do that, then you will have to face our wrath, our attack. So Bhima became very angry. He said, a Kshatriya doesn't go and beg anything from anyone. A Kshatriya takes by his own might and force. You can do what you like to stop me. I will have it. So Bhima went ahead and tried to take those flowers from there, and a ferocious battle ensued, And Bhima destroyed all the yakshas and rakshasas who had come in their hundreds. And then he went ahead, eventually he met Kuber. Kuber, he pleased Kuber, and then he got the flowers and went back. So for a Kshatriya, begging becomes intolerable. So Arjuna is stuck, is caught between two unpalatable options, between the devil and the deep blue sea, as they say. On one hand, he has the option of staying on the battlefield, fighting and killing his relatives. The other option is leaving the battlefield and begging. So he doesn't want either of the options. So he takes the middle path. What does he say? I won't leave the battlefield, but I won't fight either. I'll stay on the battlefield and I'll die, unresisting, without raising any weapons. So this is Arjuna's logic. So therefore, Arjuna is speaking not so much like a Kshatriya, because a Kshatriya shouldn't be speaking like this. He should be willing to fight. But as we have seen, Arjuna's basic mistake was, he did not realize at this point in time that he was to fight because Lord Krishna willed him to fight, not for the lure of the kingdom. And then finally, the last verse of this chapter, kindly repeat after me.
Sanjaya uvacha eva muktva arjuna sankhye ratopastha upavishat visrujya sasharam chapam shokasam vidna manasaha.
So now we are back to Sanjay. We are back in Hastinapur. Sanjay is speaking to the blind king Dhritarashtra and saying, evam uktva arjuna sankhye. So thus spoke Arjuna, where sankhye, on the battlefield. Ratho upastha upavishat, and he sat down again. Ratha upastha upavishat, he sat down on the rath again, which means that he had been standing and observing the armies, but now, after having said this, he sat down on his seat on the chariot. Visrujya sasharam chapam. Visrujya means to put aside. Sharam and chapam means bow and arrow. So he sat down, put aside his bows and arrows, and what happened? Shokasam vignamanasaha. His mind was overwhelmed with grief and lamentation. So Arjuna has become defeated by his own mind. Actually, this is our greatest enemy. Our own mind is our enemy. The greatest enemy. The greatest enemy is not outside of ourselves. Bandhuratmatmanastasya yenatmaivatmanajitah anatmanastu shatrutve vartetatmaiva shatruvat. Lord Krishna explains in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita that the mind can be our best friend if it is controlled, and the mind can be our greatest enemy if it is not controlled. So Arjuna has not been able to control his mind. So he has given way to shokasam vignamanasaha. He has given way to lamentation, grief. And he is going to be suitably reprimanded and scolded by Krishna at the beginning of the 2nd chapter. But in any case, he has taken this most extraordinary step of keeping aside the Gandiva bow, the famous Gandiva bow. Why is this such an extraordinary step? Because Arjuna had taken a terrible vow some time back. What was that vow? He said that I am so determined to destroy Duryodhana and his party because they have heaped insults on us, that anyone who even as much as suggests that I should keep down my Gandiva bow, I will kill that person. And to illustrate this point, there is a small story from Mahabharata that comes to mind. When the battle of Mahabharata was actually being fought, at one point in time, Karna, came across Yudhishthir and the two began fighting. Karna was by far a superior warrior. So after a short while, he defeated and severely injured Yudhishthir. And Yudhishthir, being totally defeated, was at the mercy of Karna. Karna also nursed great hatred towards the Pandavas. So he told Yudhishthir, because he wanted to humiliate him, he said, "You are not even a Kshatriya. You don't even know how to fight. You don't know how to hold a weapon. What is the use fighting with you? Please go and learn how to fight. It is not worthy of me to kill you. You are not worth it." So he deliberately wanted to hurt. This was the way of Kshatriyas. They would insult each other on the battlefield and provoke each other to anger. But now Yudhishthir was already grievously injured, and having been scorned in this most humiliating fashion, and he was taken away to his tent for being treated. And at that time Yudhishthir was feeling extremely sorry, and Arjun heard about this and he came straight away to the tent where Yudhishthir was being treated. Yudhishthir saw Arjun and his eyes shone, because Yudhishthir thought that Arjun, having heard that Karma had humiliated him in this way, he would have immediately gone and killed Karna. So the first question Yudhishthir asked Arjun when Arjun entered the tent, "Is Karna dead? Have you killed him?" So Arjun replied, "No, I have not killed Karna, because as soon as I heard that you were injured, I have come to see you, to see whether you are all right." So Yudhishthir became very angry. He said, "How dare you come here without avenging my humiliation? The whole honor of the Pandavas was at stake. Simply a coward. Therefore, what is the use of holding your Gandiva bow? Keep it aside." So when he heard Yudhishthir speaking like this, Arjuna's anger, and he became like a ball of fire. His eyes became red and he lifted his Gandiva bow to kill Yudhishthir. Can you imagine? Arjun was lifting his weapons, about to go for killing Yudhishthir, his own elder brother whom he adored so much and respected. Why? First of all, he was extremely hurt that someone should even suggest that he should keep down the Gandiva bow. Wow! Yudhishthir has ordered him to keep aside the Gandiva bow, so Yudhishthir deserves to be killed. So as he was about to touch his sword and his weapon, Lord Krishna was standing there. Immediately Lord Krishna held Arjun's hand and said, "Hold on for 1 minute, calm down." He said, "You want to fulfill your vow, that's all right. Your vow is that whoever suggests to you to keep down your Gandiva bow should be killed, so you can kill Yudhishthir. But for a Kshatriya, humiliation is worse than death. So if you humiliate Yudhishthir now, it is as good as killing him." So Arjun got the message. So meanwhile Yudhishthir began to be very repentant. He was very remorseful. "Oh, what did I say to Arjun?" By then Arjun, he approached Yudhishthir and he said, "You are calling me a coward? Actually you are the biggest coward. What happened when our wife Draupadi was being disrobed in the assembly? You were simply sitting and watching. And when I wanted to lift weapons, you stopped me. I could have destroyed the whole Kaurava army alone. You are not even a king, you are not even a man." And having got it out of his system, Arjuna became calm. Immediately he rushed towards Yudhishthir and touched his feet and begged forgiveness. But he was also acting according to Lord Krishna's instruction, because he had to fulfill his vow and yet not kill Yudhishthir. So Krishna was very intelligent. So in this way, Arjun insulted Yudhishthir Maharaj. So we can see that Arjun, that same Arjun who had taken such a terrible vow that anyone who even suggests that he should keep down his Gandiva bow will be killed, that same Arjuna is now keeping down that same Gandiva bow, thoroughly defeated, not by any great warrior, but by his own mind. He is keeping it down. Visrajya sasharam chapam shokasam vidnamanasah. So overwhelmed by grief and lamentation. So therefore we should realize how important it is for us to obey the instructions of the Lord. The lesson coming through this first chapter is that one who surrenders to the Lord and obeys His instructions will be peaceful and happy. One who acts of his or her own accord, out of one's own whims and fancies, will always be confused, bewildered, unhappy, miserable, and in the same condition as Arjuna. Shoka samvitna manasaha. So the message that urgently comes across in the first chapter, every now and then, as indeed the same urgent message that will come through in every chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is that we should utterly surrender to Lord Krishna. This and this alone is a central point of the Bhagavad Gita, not karmanyavadhikaraste. The fact that we must surrender utterly to Lord Krishna and become His pure devotees. This is the message of Bhagavad Gita. If after reading, hearing, studying Bhagavad Gita, someone has not become a devotee of Lord Krishna, who has surrendered his life to Him, that person has not understood the first thing about Bhagavad Gita. Because in every chapter this instruction runs through. And after hearing the whole message, then Arjuna is going to say later on in the 18th chapter, Nashto moha smriti labdha, tvat prasadan maya achyuta. By your mercy, O Achyuta, O Krishna, Nashta moha, all my illusion is gone. Smriti labdha, I have regained my memory. And therefore, Karishye vachanam tava, now I will do whatever you say. What do you want me to do, O Krishna? You want me to fight? Yes, I am ready. With my Gandiva bow in hand. So that should be our attitude as spiritual aspirants. Ready to follow Lord Krishna's will. And what is Lord Krishna's will? That we should become His devotees. So on this note, the first chapter ends. And very briefly, I wish to narrate to you one story from the Padma Purana, from the section called Gita Mahatmya. In this Gita Mahatmya section of the Padma Purana, there is the description of the glories of each of the 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. So I omitted to narrate this story at the beginning when we started the first chapter. Nevertheless, beginning or end in spiritual life, it's all the same. So I will narrate to you briefly this story that explains the importance of studying this first chapter. In this section of Padma Purana called Gita Mahatmya, we hear a narration or a dialogue taking place between Lord Shiva and Parvati Devi. So one time, Parvati Devi was sitting with Lord Shiva and she addressed him. She said, "My dear Lord, you know all the transcendental truths, and you are well aware of the science of devotion. You are well acquainted with the Bhagavad Gita. And by simply reading this Bhagavad Gita, one's devotion for the Supreme Lord increases. So please tell me something more about this Bhagavad Gita that has been spoken by Lord Krishna." So Lord Shiva replied, "That same Lord Hari, one time, after having killed the demon Mura, because of whom he is called Murari, he was resting on Anantashesh, on the milk ocean, and Lakshmi Devi asked him, 'My dear Lord, it appears that you are a little disturbed. You are the master of the whole creation, everything is working under your control. But yet you are lying here on Anantashesh.'" So Shiva was describing the situation. And before he began this description, he said, "That same Lord Hari, whose complexion is like a fresh monsoon cloud, whose vehicle is Garuda, and who is called Bhaktavatsal, for whom the devotees are very dear, and who is very dear to the devotees, he is the only object of my worship. I will narrate to you, my dear Parvati Devi, the discussion that took place between the Lord and Lakshmi Devi. So when Lakshmi Devi asked Lord Vishnu this question, he said, No, I am not disturbed. I am simply lying here and watching how wonderfully my energies are working. These energies are doing everything on their own, although they are under my control. And they are acting so wonderfully that just by studying how these energies are working, great yogis and transcendentalists have attained the perfection of life, and they have gone out of the cycle of birth and death and attained to me. In fact, I control this whole creation through the medium of my energies, and still I am separate from the creation. The creation is under my control. The creation comes from me. I sustain it, I maintain it, and then I destroy it. But everything is done through my energies. So even though I am doing all this, I am still aloof from it. So the wonderful thing about my energies is that simply by understanding more about them, automatically one attains the perfection of life. So Lakshmi Devi asked that it is so difficult to understand how your energies are working, then how is it that these energies have been described in the Bhagavad Gita? How is it possible to describe your energies? So Lord Vishnu said, my dear Lakshmi Devi, please understand that the Bhagavad Gita is not different from me. The first 5 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are my 5 heads. The next 10 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are my 10 arms. The 16th chapter is my stomach. And the 17th and 18th chapters are my 2 lotus feet. So please understand the deity form, the murti form of Bhagavad Gita. This is an interesting point. Srimad Bhagavat also is described like this, similar to Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Because these books are spiritual books, not different from the Lord Himself who has spoken. On the spiritual platform, the words and the speaker are not different. So, he said, Lakshmi Devi, please understand the deity or the murti of Bhagavad Gita. So, one who understands and worships this Bhagavad Gita by regularly studying, he will attain the same benefit that the Brahman Susharma attained. So what is the next question? Who is Susharma? What did he do? What was his caste? And what benefit and destination did he attain? So Lord Vishnu said, long time ago, there lived a man called Susharma. He belonged to the Brahman caste, but only in name. Actually, he was the most fallen person in his whole area. There was no vice or sin that Susharma did not engage in. He particularly liked drinking wine and eating flesh, even though he was born in a Brahmin family. And he made his living by getting dried leaves from the forest and selling in the market. In this way he continued his sins. And one time as he was going out in the forest, he was bitten by a snake. And he died. And because he was so sinful, he had to suffer many lifetimes in hell. And after he had suffered all these hellish punishments, he was reborn as a bull. And a farmer came to possess this bull. And the farmer used to overwork this bull very much. So one time this bull was so overworked that out of sheer exhaustion, he fell down unconscious and he died. There are so many onlookers and passers-by who came and they were all clucking, oh poor bull, he has died. And one amongst them, he declared, this poor bull has died working so hard, so I want to give it the gift of whatever pious deeds I may have done. I want to award this so that it will go to the bull's account. You see, all of us have a debit and credit account with Yamaraj. Our accounts are being maintained there. So we have to answer for all our activities. So this man said, from my books, whatever is in my credit, I award to this bull. Because he felt sorry, he felt compassion for this bull. So when he said like this, the others around him also became inspired. Yes, I offer whatever piety I have done. And there happened to be one prostitute who was there also. So she said, if at all there is any pious activity I have done in my life, I offer it for the welfare of this poor bull. And the soul of the bull in due course of time reached the abode of Lord Yama, Yamaraj. And the decision came. And immediately Yamaraj told him, well, now you are going to get a very good birth in a very highly qualified Brahmin family. So this bull, rather this the Atma who was formerly in the bull, he said, I have committed so many sins, so how is it that I am going to get such a high birth? Is it because of the piety of all those people that was transferred to me? He said, not because of all of them, because of that one prostitute who gave you her piety. What? That one prostitute had so much piety? So he got birth as a highly qualified Brahmin. And then he decided to search out, where is this prostitute? Finally he managed to locate her. He was blessed by the Lord with memory of his previous lives. So he traced her out and said, please tell me, what is it that you have done that just by transferring your pious credits to me, I have become delivered from hell and I have got this highly qualified birth? So she said, well, I have just heard some things from my parrot. I had a parrot with me in a cage and this parrot keeps chanting some things and I keep chanting with him. So because I chanted with him, that was the only pious activity I have ever done in my life. So I transferred the credit of that to you. So the Brahmin became very eager to know, so what is it that he was chanting? Let us go and ask the parrot. So they approached the parrot. The parrot said, you see, in my previous life, I was a Brahmin, but I was very sinful. So after I died, again I was sent to hell. And after being for one or two lifetimes in hell, I got the body of a parrot. But because I had so many sins, my mother and father died when I was just born, and I was suffering in the hot sands. And then somebody, some rishis who happened to be nearby, took compassion on me and took me away and put me in the cage. And the children of these rishis were daily chanting the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So because they were first chanting always, and I was in the cage and hearing, so I learned to imitate that chanting, and I also learned the whole chanting of Bhagavad Gita. And then, after some time, some thieves stole me from there, and they sold me in the market, and this lady happened to purchase me. So therefore, whenever I chant the first chapter of Gita, she has been chanting with me. So Susharma was very, who was formerly Susharma, he was very astonished to hear this. And then all three of them sat together and began to chant the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita repeatedly. And then Lord Vishnu completed the narration by saying that all those who chant my narrations and my messages in this way will surely transcend the cycle of birth and death and return home to me, back to Godhead. My dear Lakshmi Devi, if somebody chants one chapter every day, or even one verse every day, or even half a verse, or even one quarter of a verse of Bhagavad Gita every day, he will attain the perfection of life. So, thus ends the glories of the first chapter of Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. So now we will have darshan of the same Lord Krishna who spoke Bhagavad Gita, and after that we will have questions and answers, and please wait for the prasadam thereafter. Hare Krishna. You like the darshan? This is one of the sweetest darshans. The same darshan is also there tomorrow early morning, 4:30, if you wish to come. But if not, then this darshan is also as good. So, do you have any questions?
This Bhagavad Gita is narrated by Krishna to Arjuna. But actually, who has written this? And it is from one more point of view that Krishna had already narrated this earlier to son and then to Vivasvan and so on. So he said that the meaning, the actual meaning was lost, so again he had to narrate it to Arjuna. So what Bhagavad Gita today we are reading is the original without having any deviation from what he said that time to Arjuna.
Vedic literatures are usually narrations within narrations within narrations. So this is the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna as reported by Sanjay to Dhritarashtra, as reported by Vedavyas, and later on as reported by King Janmajaya by the sage Vaishampayan, because it appears in Mahabharata. So this is the narration of the Bhagavad Gita as it exists today. When Lord Krishna speaks in Bhagavad Gita, Imam Vivasvate Yogam Proktavan Aham Avyayam, that I spoke this message to the Sun God, what he means is that the same knowledge was spoken earlier. It need not have been exactly the same order, the same sequence of the verses, the same number of the verses, etc. But the point is that the same knowledge has been eternally existing, because the Veda or true spiritual knowledge is eternal. It comes from the breathing of Lord Narayan. Only time to time it manifests in a particular form and shape at a particular point in time. Let me give a simple example. Say the subject of mathematics. It has been existing for centuries. Today if somebody writes a textbook, and let us assume that some mathematics for some centuries, and then somebody again starts writing some textbooks on the same knowledge that was there earlier. He may not write the same textbook exactly in the same format, but the same concepts, the same ideas are there. So similarly, the knowledge that was originally propounded by Lord Krishna to Vivasvan, the Sun God, has been spoken again in a sense to Arjuna. And that is what we are also repeating. The point is that the essential knowledge is the same. Is there any other question?
When Arjun with his intellect, he has actually given the four reasons for his not fighting against the war. Now this he has given by his intellect. So how can you say that like mind has overtaken his intellect? And he's because of mind he has become so much.
Yes, but as I mentioned, Arjun has made a basic flaw. What was that flaw? He thought he was fighting this battle for his own enjoyment. But actually he was fighting because it was Lord Krishna's desire. If Arjuna understood this point at this point in time, he would not have been disillusioned. But because he forgot this point, that I should fight this battle because the Lord wants me to fight, I should be an instrument in his mission, then he would have been peaceful. So also, we will also be peaceful if we simply lead our life as instruments of Lord Krishna, following his orders. Then this is the formula for peace and happiness in the whole human society. Speciality means that it was the bow specially given by Agnidev to Arjuna. It was very, very powerful. We discussed several weeks ago about how Arjun got hold of the Gandiv bow and his chariot. If you remember, we narrated from the Mahabharata. So the Gandiv bow was very special, very dear to Arjun, because he used that to vanquish so many powerful. So fond was he of this and so determined to take revenge that he had taken this vow. That if anyone ever suggests to me that I should keep the Gandiv down, I will kill that person. Also a small lesson to us that we should not take vows so easily. We may come in trouble later because of them. We should think carefully before taking vows. Any other, somebody else raised the hand there? Please.
In this 18th chapter of Gita, 5 are the heads and 10 arms, and then stomach, and how do you narrate that?
Lord Krishna, Lord Vishnu is just giving a description of himself in his larger form. He is explaining that basically the Bhagavad Gita, being his own word, his own message, is not different from himself. So when we are studying the Bhagavad Gita, handling the Bhagavad Gita, we should know that this is directly Lord Krishna himself. In sound form, in literary form, there is no difference. So this is the deity form. This is the form of Lord Krishna in sound or in words. So we have to consider this as non-different from the literary incarnation. That is the point that is conveyed by this analogy. Uttam. It is explained that the earlier cantos are like the lotus feet, then the knees, then the waist, then the chest, then the neck, and then finally the 10th canto is the lotus face of Lord Krishna. So the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is compared to the beautiful form of Lord Krishna. Likewise, Lord Vishnu is comparing the Bhagavad Gita also to his own form. Is there any other question? Yes. Mike?
Hare Krishna. Prabhuji, you had earlier explained that Vishnu is, he's saying that many people attain perfection by studying his various energies. Could you explain this a little bit?
Because in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains his energies very clearly. Isn't it? It bhumirapa nalavayu kammano buddhre vacha ahankaritiyam me bhinna prakritirashtadha. He is describing how his energies exist, how they interact, how they work, and how they are to be overcome. The three modes of nature, sattvagun, rajagun, tamagun. So from Bhagavad Gita, we should try to understand these ideas and these concepts. We should not think it is too burdensome for us to apply our intelligence and mind to it. We should try to understand these things. And we should also learn how to transcend these gunas and come to the spiritual platform. So what Lord Krishna is trying to say is that in Bhagavad Gita we find not only information about the spiritual world, we also find information about this material world, about how this material world is a cause of bondage for all of us and how we can become free from this bondage and go back to the spiritual world. Can you give the mic?
Krishna Prabhuji, I don't know whether I'm correct or what, but there is a little bit confusion that as you told that we all have to be instruments in the Lord's hands. So, what is exactly the meaning of that? Means, even if we are devotees or non-devotees, we all are instruments in God's hands. Because we all are performing our activities by His wish only. It's, nothing can happen without His will. So, what is exactly meaning of being instruments in His hands? Like?
What is the job of an instrument? To act according to the way the worker wants to use it, isn't it? If I'm sitting in front of a computer, then computer should do what I want it to do. Computer does something on its own. I want something to happen. I press the letter F, it prints A. It's not a good instrument. I want it to do something, it is doing something of its own. So good instrument means it does what the master wants it to do. So as human beings, we should be good instruments in the sense, let Lord Krishna mold our lives and our activities and our thoughts the way He likes. So if Arjuna, He wanted Arjuna to fight, Arjuna should have been willing to fight. If He wanted Arjuna to stop fighting, He should be willing to stop fighting. We should be willing to become puppets in the hands of the Lord. As regards the point that everybody is an instrument in the hands of the Lord, that is true. But those who are surrendered souls are willing instruments and others are unwilling instruments. And you know what happens when there is unwilling instrument? I am accustomed to many telephones which work when you bang them. They stop, they don't work. Many instruments, tape recorders, just bang them and they start working. I don't know what is the technology that makes it work like that, but it happens. So unwilling instruments, like the Lord, sometimes have to be banged by the Lord to make them work. So they have to undergo a lot of suffering. And then they surrender to Krishna and start working. So the suffering that we undergo in this world is Lord Krishna trying to make us pliable instruments in His hands. Krishna wants all living beings to be good instruments, but we are resisting. We have our own independence, we don't want to surrender that independence because of our false ego. So we tell Krishna, you have your department, I have my department. When I'm doing bhakti, this much time a day up to this extent, but beyond this, please don't interfere in my personal life. So Krishna wants our everything. He wants us to be totally in His control. In any case, we are totally in His control. Those who are non-devotees are in the control of His maya, of His illusory energy. Just like all of us are working within the control of the government, of the state. Those who are law-abiding citizens, because they follow the authority of the state, we are free to move here and there. But still, we are controlled by the state. Those who are prisoners who try to violate the laws of the state, they are sent to jail. There also they are subjected to the laws of the state, but different laws apply for them, which are very harsh, very strict. So those who surrender to the Lord voluntarily and accept His control, they become happy, good instruments. But those who refuse to surrender to the Lord, they are used by the Lord as instruments anyway. But they have to suffer for it. They are unwilling instruments. So therefore they have to stay on in the cycle of birth and death again and again. But willing instruments, they please the Lord very much. And then we go back to Godhead. And we don't have to come back to this material world again.
We have to be that willing instruments. Now what happens, like many times we have to be fully surrendered, but because maybe our stubbornness or many times, sometimes we surrender but sometimes we don't surrender as per the instructions of the Lord or maybe the Vaishnavas, the Lord's instruction through Vaishnavas and all. So how to overcome this, like how to be fully surrendered, like?
Sometimes surrendered, sometimes not surrendered means not surrendered. That means we are still on the platform of the mind. Mind, sankalpa vikalpa manaha. Mind means sometimes accept something, sometimes reject something. Sometimes you like one person very much, after 5 minutes you don't like him. This is the mind. So mind says sometimes we feel very enthusiastic. Let me surrender everything to Lord Krishna today. Today I promise I will become the best devotee. Then tomorrow somehow our determination comes down and we have some other thoughts. I'm thinking maybe day after. I made that in a hurry, that decision. So when we advance in spiritual life, we become more determined, our mind becomes more steady and stable. When we reach a higher platform, then our enthusiasm becomes steady. And our surrender becomes more and more complete. There is no limit to surrender. So therefore we should endeavor. Of course it's a big subject. But I will cut it short by just saying that surrender can be achieved by simply following the Lord's instructions. Accepting whatever is favorable for surrender. And renouncing whatever is not favorable for surrender. That is the formula. If we simply follow this, anukulyasya sankalpaha pratikulyasya vivarjanam. Give up what is unfavorable for surrendering to the Lord, accept what is favorable for surrender to the Lord, and that will help us to move on the path of surrender.
Hare Krishna, Hare Swamiji. Swamiji, you were talking about Shraad, and only sons can do it. So is there a ban on women or girls to do the Shraad?
Generally the system is that the son is supposed to do. That is a system. Pumnamatrayate Pumnama Narakatrayate iti putraha. However, for a devotee, it doesn't matter. For a devotee of the Lord, he or she is not dependent on sons and grandsons and others to deliver them. He is dependent only on his own devotion and the grace of the Lord. And similarly, the person who is a descendant is not obliged to do the Shraddha because he is already surrendered to the Lord. So in devotional life, this consideration does not apply. One should simply just render devotional service to the Lord, and that is sufficient in itself.
I was asking, is it okay, I mean, should the women do the Shraddha or no?
Usually that is not the process. They may participate in the ceremony.
No, the pindan.
Yeah, the ceremony they may participate in as per the injunctions. Their involvement is required. Just like when Lord Ram was in the forest and Dasharatha Maharaj passed away, he did the whole ceremony there and Sita Devi participated in the whole ceremony. Ultimately the actual ceremony had to be performed by Lord Ram, being the eldest son. But the women folk participate in the function. But it needs the son to actually do that.
Which the so what happens?
Yes. Well, that is why having a son is considered a sign of piety. When you have a son, this is the Vedic system. Having a son means there is some piety. Having no son means there is some flaw in one's previous life. So there is no son. So to get out of this cycle, you just have to come to bhakti. Then no problem. Doesn't matter. Son, daughter, no children, unmarried, doesn't matter. No, it should be done by the other male descendant. Some other male descendant. Well, somebody will be there, then you should become a devotee. Simple. That is the system. So therefore we are not so much concerned with these ritualistic processes, because one is satisfied simply by becoming a devotee. This is the easy way, as they say in Hindi, Ram Ban Upai. Just take shelter of this and everything else, all other purposes are accomplished. Yes.
Hello?
Hare.
The essence of the completion of the first chapter, you have beautifully elucidated in this small story where the essence has contained in that story. The Lord is totally pleased to shower His benedictions, blessings, love and spiritual strength upon the devotee. Now, the unfortunate devotee like me, I do not know Sanskrit. So, understanding or reciting a verse with a meaning is more beautiful. So, even if you go through the meanings, English meaning or the vernacular meanings, then the same is extended.
Certainly. You can imagine if the parrot got this benefit, parrot didn't know the meaning, that prostitute got the benefit, she did not know the meaning, and If the two of them got this benefit simply by chanting without knowing the meaning even, how much more benefit we will get if we chant by knowing the meaning, by reciting with devotion, with faith, we will get far greater benefit. So these are illustrative stories to show us how important it is for us to regularly study, read, hear the Bhagavad Gita and to practice in our own life. It doesn't matter whether we are Sanskrit pandits or not. Nowadays it is more of a disadvantage than an advantage, because then it often causes pride. And because of that pride, we cannot make advancement in spiritual life. So Prabhupada has given such wonderful translation. Each word has been given a meaning. There is a commentary, there is a translation. So one need not learn Sanskrit. And in fact, if you just read Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, you will automatically learn Sanskrit. Just by reading those translations and the word for word meanings. So thank you very much for your kind and patient hearing. It's quite late today.